You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Hey folks, it's Ben Mathis here with just a quick favor to ask. We love having great advertisers support the show, but in order to continue doing that, we need your help. So please go to podsurvey.com/kick and take a quick anonymous survey that'll help us get to know you a little better. That way we can show advertisers just how enthusiastic our audience is about Kick-Ass News and keep the show free for listeners like you. Even if you've taken our podcast listener survey before, the current one is new and different, and it's really important that we have lots of listener feedback, so I'd really appreciate it if you take a minute to fill out this new one. Plus, as a thank you, once you've completed the survey, you can enter to win a $100 Amazon gift card. Again, that's podsurvey.com/kick, podsurvey.com/kick. Thanks for your help, and thanks for listening. Today's podcast is sponsored by Nadex. Do you want to try day trading the markets but worried about the risk? What if you could choose your maximum risk and reward up front? Well, you can with binary options on Nadex. Trade global stock indexes, commodities, Forex, even economic numbers, all from one account and always with limited risk. See for yourself why over 100,000 members choose Nadex. Find out more at Nadex.com. Trading on Nadex involves risk and may not be appropriate for all investors. And now, enjoy the podcast.
Just this week, Michelle Bachmann actually predicted that I would bring about the biblical end of days. Now that's a legacy. That's big. I mean, Lincoln, Washington, they didn't do that.
That was a clip of President Barack Obama's speech at the 2016 White House Correspondents' Dinner. The annual event, known inside the Beltway as Nerd Prom, where the Washington press gets to gently poke fun at the most powerful man in the world, and the president gets to give it right back to them. The man behind many of President Obama's clever barbs and self-deprecating quips for that and other lighthearted occasions like the Al Smith dinner and that famous Between Two Ferns interview with Zach Galifianakis is the speechwriter known as the president's comic muse, David Litt. After having written for the satirical news site The Onion and campaigned for the 2008 Obama-Biden campaign, David Litt entered the White House as a speechwriter to presidential advisor Valerie Jarrett, along the way writing jokes for President Obama's speeches, humorous videos, and birthday greetings, among other tasks. That led to David Litt's promotion to special assistant to the president and senior presidential speechwriter, composing serious policy speeches for President Obama by day, while continuing to moonlight as the head writer for the president's White House correspondence dinners and inserting a little levity whenever he could get away with it. Now he writes about it in an entertaining memoir titled Thanks, Obama, My Hopey, Changey White House Years. And today, David Litt joins me on the podcast to talk about his political coming of age, what it's really like working in the West Wing, and battling with his sometimes nemesis, the White House fact checker. David shares his most emotional moment from his White House years and the surprising thrill of Obama's second term when the president decided to swing for the fences instead of being a lame duck. Plus, the art of self-censorship, self-deprecation as a political tool, and some of the jokes that didn't make it into the president's correspondence dinner speech. Coming up with Obama's funny man, David Litt, in just a moment. Today I'm joined by David Litt, who served as a special assistant to the president and senior presidential speechwriter in the Obama White House, but he was more popularly known as Obama's joke man. He's written about it in an entertaining new memoir titled Thanks, Obama, My Hopey-Changey White House Years. David, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the title is a play on this cynical dig that Sarah Palin had made where she said, what was it? How's that hopey-changey thing working for you? You talk about being a true believer in the 2008 election who believed in the hope and the change. I don't know if you ever abandoned that per se, but after 8 years, I think your idea of hope and change perhaps evolved. In many ways, this book is less of a memoir than a political coming-of-age story. Talk a little about that.
Yeah, what I say in the very introduction of the book is Sarah Palin had this kind of mocking question, how's that whole hopey-changey thing working out for you? But if you ignore the tone, it was actually a pretty good question because people like me, I was not super political. Then I saw Barack Obama speak. It completely changed my life. And I devoted the decade that my friends were traveling the world or like getting in really good shape, I was going around in a suit and tie, you know, with business cards in my pocket, even on the weekends. I became this kind of cliche Washington 20-something, and it was certainly for a great job. I mean, I got to write speeches for President Obama, but I wanted to look back and say, not just was it worth it, and, you know, spoiler alert, I do think it was, but also why was it worth it? Because the, as you said, my definition of hope and change, my relationship with President Obama, not just the personal relationship that didn't exist at the beginning of the book and by the end did, even if we weren't close, but the relationship with the idea of Barack Obama, that changed over time too. And the reasons that I'm proud of everything my colleagues and I did weren't necessarily the reasons I would have predicted in 2008.
What did you do during the election? You were registering voters or what?
Yeah, so I was a senior in college in 2008, and I became one of those college kids who would not shut up about Barack Obama. And, you know, we were everywhere at the time. And I did want to write about that, too, because that idea of a political figure and politics being so exciting and emotional seems harder to remember than ever these days. But It wasn't that long ago where there was this kind of political awakening. And I graduated in May 2008. A couple weeks after that, I drove to Ohio, and I started off as an unpaid organizing fellow, so basically an indentured servant for the campaign. Then I graduated to underpaid field organizer, but officially on the campaign staff. And that was my job, to be in a part of Ohio that was never going to go for Obama, but to try to do what we could to get out the vote in that county.
And after the election, you took a leap of faith and moved to D.C. expecting you were going to be able to get a job in the Obama White House. That took a little longer than expected. You talk about how there was a distinction between the post-Iowa and the pre-Iowa Obama people.
Exactly. There were thousands of organizers hired when I was in 2008. The way I put it is I was into Barack Obama at exactly the moment he was cool. You know, it was 2008. He was winning. He was a viable candidate. There were many people, and many of them are now my friends, who decided I'm going to drop everything and work my heart out for Barack Obama when he was down 20, 30 points in the polls to Hillary in the 2008 campaign. This was in 2007. And so, and this I say was pretty fair. When we got to Washington, the people who believed early on and the people who were willing to devote themselves to this, even when it was a long shot, they were usually first in line for jobs. That's not something that I particularly minded or felt was unfair. I also write about then there were other ways that you sort of get a sense Washington is not maybe as cynical and broken as everybody thinks it is, but it's also not the kind of meritocracy that a campaign can be. Because on a campaign, there's not enough time. If you can do the job, someone will promote you because their election day is coming up. You got to win. In Washington, there's a little bit more of a wait your turn system. Sometimes people who find a way to cut in line do get ahead. And coming to terms with that, squaring the reality of D.C. with the idealism of the 2008 campaign, I do think is probably a theme, not just in that early chapter, but throughout the book.
And while you were playing the waiting game there, you worked for a while for, I think, a crisis management firm. What kind of stuff did you do for them?
Well, I did. I was quite possibly the worst intern in Washington, D.C. for several months. And there's a lot of interns in D.C., so that takes real effort. And I detail some of that effort in the book. I started off working for this firm because I thought it would be a month or two, I'd find my place in the Obama world somehow. Everything was going to be fine. But I worked for this firm. Our clients, generally speaking, were companies that were in crisis because they deserved to be in crisis. So Wall Street banks during the 2008 economic crisis. So you know,
the opposite of hopey change.
It was as unhopey and unchangey as you could get. It was you know, coal companies where mines were collapsing and workers were being injured. Not at all idealistic stuff. But to be fair, it's not like I handled this in a mature way. What I did was I stopped obeying the dress code. I had studied abroad in China for a semester, and I had a collection of shirts that were themes on polyester or were variations of the theme of polyester. And I started only wearing these very gaudy, shiny polyester shirts, and I brought my laptop in from home, and I set up an office in the break room. And people who actually worked there would walk by the cubicle, which was now empty, where I was supposed to be, and then into the break room to get a snack, and they would find the intern sitting there working on his laptop, which is totally unacceptable, and I don't know why I thought this was okay. But the reason I did it was because I didn't want anyone to see, as they walked behind me, that I was playing Minesweeper instead of working. And then, because I'm not obnoxious enough in this story, and then I reached, I'd say, the apex of my rogue intern phase, where I would only answer work-related questions in analogies to the game of Minesweeper I was playing at the time. So somebody would ask, like, how's that memo going? And I would say, well, you know, it's like the end of a game of Minesweeper. The beginning was really easy, but now there's 5 mines and 7 squares left, so you know that the stakes are high. It could be a while before that memo's done. And I thought I was getting away with it until it became clearly obvious that I was not. They basically said, we don't want to have to fire an intern for the first time ever, so please stop behaving like this. And I realized very quickly that I was not above asking for a second chance. So I was very lucky to get it.
So after that illustrious start, how did you eventually get hired on at the White House, and what was that process like?
Well, luckily, they didn't check those particular references. Yeah. That was important. I say this in the book. I did feel like it was important to say how lucky I got, because I do think, you know, I went to Yale, which is kind of like that's the kind of fancy pants university where you end up building a network without meaning to. Mm-hmm. And I'm a white guy, and I think there's some ways in which that helped. And more importantly than all that, my parents could help me pay the rent for a little bit out of college. And mm-hmm. so I got a second chance after being a terrible intern when other people who deserved one might not have. Hmm. I ended up getting another internship. I was an intern at a firm called West Wing Writers, and that was all former Clinton speechwriters. They had started this private sector firm, so they wrote for politicians, CEOs, totally without meaning to. I stumbled upon this chance to learn a very specialized skill. And the firm, the associates at the firm were leaving to go join the administration, and I was suddenly the most senior person of the junior level people as an intern because there were no more junior level people left. So they needed to hire somebody, and I was there. They hired me. And that's how I ended up learning the craft of speech writing, which has a lot to do with similar types of other types of writing, but it's not identical. Mm-hmm. And so there are specific things you need to learn as a speechwriter.
Well, what are some of those rules that you learned?
Well, one of the things you learn very quickly is you're always working with clients, whether it's the president or anybody else, to try to figure out what's the main idea they're hoping to express. So not to give away too big a trick of the trade, but for example, what I learned to do was ask people, if you give the speech and then someone in the audience sees it and they tell their friend about the speech the next day, what do you want that person to tell their friend the speech was about? Because if I ask you, let's say I'm writing a speech for you, and I say, what do you want the speech to be about? You're going to tell me a 5-minute long list of things. Yeah. But when I put you in the frame of someone in the audience, you realize, oh, there's only room for just one sentence. Mm-hmm. So what's that going to be? So it's little ways of getting the most specific, pertinent information out of the people you're writing for.
Yeah, and I was interested to read that you said that from one person to another, the speech isn't that different, really.
That's right. There are exceptions, right? If you're John F. Kennedy, if you're Ronald Reagan, if you're Barack Obama, you have a voice. If you're you and me, you probably don't. And the reason for that is most of the time on paper, the words and the rhetoric look the same. It's not that one person has one vocabulary, another person has a totally different one. What makes different speakers different are their thoughts and the way those thoughts are organized. So when I was writing, for example, for Valerie Jarrett, the president's senior advisor, and then at the same time I was also writing for Bill Daley, his chief of staff, the difference was not so much in the words I would use. The main difference was Valerie would want to talk about a specific set of things. She might have a story or a thing that she thought was most important when she wanted to phrase or frame an issue, and Bill might have a different set of priorities. And trying to figure out what those are and organize them so that they go, rather than being a list with no coherence, they're more of a story. They start at a logical starting point and they end at a logical end point.
How intimidating was that interview process when you went through Samantha Power and Valerie Jarrett? What was that like?
It was absolutely terrifying.
Yeah.
Well, it was one of the reasons I wrote this book was that it's obviously about my time at the White House, but it's also for anybody who's been 24 and in an interview with someone who you admire and look up to, and how scary that can be. I hope that's a more universal experience.
Yeah.
And for example, I was in the interview with Mike Strautmanis, who everyone calls Strat, Valerie's chief of staff. And Strat said, okay, I'm going to leave for an hour. Why don't you write a speech?
On the spot.
And that's not how speechwriting job interviews are supposed to work. I don't know if he knew that and was just seeing if I could handle the pressure or if he hadn't interviewed a speechwriter before, so he thought, I'll give it a shot. Either way, I sat down and had a momentary panic attack. And then this, I think, was good training for a White House job. I thought, okay, I can't waste my time panicking and wondering whether or not I can do it. I just have to go do it. And I wrote this speech for a business group and pulled together whatever I could. An hour later, he came back. And I remember thinking, okay, you know, maybe next week I'll get a call back and I'll get to meet with Valerie. And Strat said, well, let's go see if Valerie's free now. And so then we go straight to the West Wing. And I have this moment where I'm like, I'm in the West Wing.
Yeah.
This is terrifying and bizarre. Like, I don't belong in the West Wing. This is the White House of the United States. But I don't have time to think about all that because I go straight in and talk to Valerie. And, you know, she was – it's interesting. My first interview with her didn't last that long. It was maybe 10 minutes, 15 tops. And it was only after that where Strat started saying, so, you know, what's your salary at your current job or whatever, that I started to realize, oh, I just got a White House job. This is pretty crazy.
Yeah, you say that you're a fan of the West Wing. West Wing.
Well, the similarity is clearly all your listeners don't get to see this, but I look exactly like Rob Lowe. So let's get that out of the way. The differences are, number one, there's just more people there. So the West Wing on the show, there's like 6 or 7 people with the president, which makes sense. It's a TV show. Mm-hmm. I was not Rob Lowe on the West Wing. I wasn't Toby. I wasn't Donna. I was like somebody who hands Rob Lowe a piece of paper and then scurries out of the frame because they don't want to pay that actor if they would have to give him, you know, extra money if he had a line. That was me. So that was a big part of it, just the number of people doing the work. And the other major difference just physically is the West Wing on the West Wing looks like this very cool, exciting, big office space. Like, there's a bullpen, there's lots of people, everyone has enough space, but, you know, it's close enough that everyone can have these clever conversations. In the actual West Wing, there's no space. It is a cramped building. I talk about how on the basement floor where most people come in, sometimes it smelled a little sewagey because the men's room was there, and this building has not been renovated in a while.
Yeah.
And so that's not a feature of the West Wing on TV, but those things were absolutely a feature of the actual West Wing.
Yeah, that's interesting. I don't think that a lot of people do realize just how small those quarters are, because I think it was added during the Teddy Roosevelt administration or something. And there's really not anywhere you can expand physically on the property from there.
That's exactly right. I worked in the executive office building, which is across the street, this sort of pedestrian street. It's all in the same campus, so you have to go through security to get in. But that's what they did as the White House staff expanded. They moved everyone into what used to be the Department of War, and it's this big 5-story massive building that looks – it doesn't look like a traditional office building, but it looks the size of a traditional office building, and then just a few people work in the actual West Wing.
And talking about the size of the support staff that the president has, you know, if you're watching, say, the West Wing – most people probably think that the president has one speechwriter who writes everything, but the speechwriters are broken down into someone who will specialize in tragic events like a school shooting or something, the guy who writes speeches on foreign policy or race speeches. What was your wheelhouse as a speechwriter?
Well, the way it worked for us, and every White House does this differently, I wasn't hired as like the economic speechwriter or the education speechwriter. The brightest line we had was between the foreign policy writers and the domestic policy writers. Mm-hmm. So I didn't do a lot of foreign trips. The other thing was then within that, you sort of develop these kind of little niches. So you write the speech on the minimum wage, which I did in 2014, I think. And then the next time a minimum wage speech comes up, you do it again because the main thing that you're always fighting in the White House is there's too much to do in too little time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how you develop these kind of specialties. It's not that I was a minimum wage expert then or even now. It's just that I knew how to talk about it in that way. My first sort of niche at the White House was basically anything no one else wants. That was my specialty.
Okay.
I think that's true of a lot of people as they start out in their careers. And it was certainly true of me. You know, there was a Thanksgiving Day video. There's the president is going to say happy birthday and a video greeting to a friend of his from Chicago.
Yeah.
Little stuff like that I would volunteer to take. And the other thing I ended up doing, I did a lot of the speeches for the American Jewish community because I went to 8 years of Hebrew school growing up, and I was always kind of like, why? And then the president spoke to the Union of Reform Judaism's biennial summit in 2011, and I was like, oh, this is why.
I got
this. Is my moment. Yeah, I got this. I know how to write a speech. Right? You know, I'm not necessarily going to be the guy who can write the tragedy speech or the econ speech nearly as well as my colleagues, but I can write this one. And so that was one of my first sort of specialties at the White House. And then I ended up doing a lot of the jokes because when I started at the White House, John Lovett, who was one of the president's speechwriters, now he hosts his own podcasts, he was kind of our in-house funny person. And then at the end of 2011, he left for Hollywood, and that meant that we were looking for a new token in-house funny person, and I was that guy by default. So there was a team of writers working on these things, but I was the kind of point person for a couple of years on the correspondence dinners and some of the other jokes.
Yeah. How many correspondence dinners did you work on? Because you were head writer on, I think, four of them, right? But you were already writing jokes prior to that for him.
Yeah, I started off pitching jokes in 2009, actually, not for the correspondence dinner, for another one of these, through my speechwriting firm, and got a couple of jokes in, just like there were 10 or 12 other people around the country pitching jokes. And then starting in 2012, that's the first year where if the correspondence dinner had gone badly, I would have felt personally responsible. I would have been like, okay, that was my fault. And that's how I always thought about it. And I did that for till 2015. So four of those dinners, basically team effort to make it go well. If it had gone badly, it would have been on me. And it was fun because for 11 months out of the year, I was writing serious speeches about America in all sorts of different ways. But then you got to take a month and just put on a completely different hat and write jokes. Except there was one year where because of my two kind of intersections, American Jewish community and correspondence dinner aligned or intersected rather, I was writing the correspondence dinner and working on that. And then I was also President Obama was coming to Los Angeles to deliver a speech about Holocaust commemoration for Steven Spielberg's foundation.
Okay.
And I was also working on that. So it was kind of, I would spend
you didn't get those two mixed up, did
that
you?
That was my concern. In the sitcom version of my life, yeah, that's exactly right. The sitcom version of my life, you know, the president gets up at the Holocaust event and starts telling jokes. Thankfully, that did not happen, but it was very strange. It was one of those kind of little moments where you don't think about this part of a White House job, but you have to learn to compartmentalize where you're going from, okay, now I'm thinking about how do we as a people remember this awful event and make the words never again real? And then also, how do I come up with some funny thing to say about a comment that Maureen Dowd made, and to go back and forth?
Now, a politician can't necessarily go for the funniest thing that pops into his head. I mean, maybe now he can, but was the White House a bit of a crash course in self-censorship for you?
I guess it was in a strange way. Not so much in what I would say in meetings or anything like that. I do feel like the main thing about writing for a president, certainly writing for President Obama, was that every word wasn't just going to be seen and heard by the American people, it was also going to be taken out of context by people who didn't like him.
Mm-hmm.
So you started to self-censor in that way. You would have to look through, for totally good reason, you'd look through and say, not only what does the sentence mean, but what could it be misconstrued to mean?
Mm-hmm.
And being able to try to write well while also writing defensively is very difficult. To me, that was one of the things that White House speechwriters, that my colleagues were very good at, that you wouldn't necessarily think about with a speechwriter. There's plenty of speechwriters who were brilliant, who could take those big swings, but also couldn't in the back of their mind think, but how do we make sure to protect the president while we're doing that?
Is there one of those jokes that never made it into a speech, but that you were particularly proud of?
Well, I talk in the book about a joke that we knew was not going to make it into the speech, but I wanted to bring it into the Oval Office just because I thought it was that funny. And it wasn't mine. My former boss, Jeff Nussbaum, wrote it. And Vice President Biden had just been on the stump, and he had said something. This was in 2012. And so he's talking about the president's foreign policy prowess, and he said, "This is a man with a big stick." And he made a hand gesture that didn't necessarily indicate international diplomacy. We'll put it that way.
Yeah.
And so the joke referenced that. And then the punchline was, let me just put it this way. Dreams aren't the only thing I got from my father. And we knew, part of me was like, maybe the president will go for it. I'm glad he didn't. It was clear, would have clearly been a bad decision. But I remember just feeling like we have to tell the president that joke because it's just too funny. And he thought it was funny, and there was absolutely no chance it was going to ever end up in the speech. Thank goodness.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with David Litt when we come back in just a moment. I gotta tell you, folks, I've been eating extremely well lately thanks to HelloFresh. HelloFresh is the meal kit delivery service that makes cooking more fun, so you can focus on the whole experience, not just the final plate. Each week, HelloFresh creates new delicious recipes with step-by-step instructions designed to take around 30 minutes for everyone from novices like myself to seasoned home cooks short on time. They source the freshest ingredients delivered right to your doorstep in a recyclable insulated box for free, and they measure everything to the exact quantities needed, so there's no food waste. They even employ 2 full-time registered dietitians who review each recipe to ensure it's nutritionally balanced. HelloFresh is now offering light fall meals, and they've just introduced breakfast options, all for less than $10 a meal. I've been making these delicious meals from HelloFresh for several months now, and I'm so excited about it that I even ordered HelloFresh for my parents. They're empty nesters now, and my poor mom doesn't need to cook for an army anymore and deal with a big kitchen mess. So the quick and easy recipes from HelloFresh with their pre-portioned ingredients work perfectly for them. And if you're a family who likes to cook together, it's a great bonding experience, something you can do together with your spouse or your kids. Or even if you're a total amateur in the kitchen like me, you don't have to live on takeout or fast food. You can prepare delicious restaurant-quality meals in no time. This week, we made HelloFresh's buttered up steak with roasted potatoes and garlicky green beans. The sirloin steak was really good quality, the kind that you would get from a family butcher you really trust. Tender, not too fatty, had great flavor. The green beans and potatoes were fresh and tasty, and it actually took us less than 30 minutes with no hassle and very little cleanup. So give HelloFresh a try, and you're going to be glad that you did. In fact, you can even get $30 off your first week of deliveries by visiting HelloFresh.com and entering KICK30 when you subscribe. That's HelloFresh.com and promo code KICK30 for $30 off your first week. Now, just to give you a sampling of the kind of meals HelloFresh offers, some of their upcoming menus include spiced Dijon salmon with apple arugula salad and couscous. Or how about honey-glazed pork tenderloin with sweet potatoes and green beans? I can't wait for that one. And if you want to get in on those great meals too, go to HelloFresh.com and enter our special promo code KICK30 when you subscribe to get $30 off your first week of deliveries. One more time, that's HelloFresh.com and KICK30 at checkout for $30 off your first week. Delicious ingredients you'll love to eat, simple recipes you'll live to cook. HelloFresh, get cooking. And now, back to the podcast. Now, did the president have a pretty good natural sense of humor by your standards?
Absolutely. That was one of the things that is true, not just with comedy, but broader speech writing. It's really hard to fake it. If somebody sounds inspiring and they're a good speaker, they probably are pretty inspiring. If somebody sounds like they don't really know what they're talking about, they probably don't. And President Obama sounded funny because he's a funny person. And more than that, he has a sense of timing and a real sense of audience. And that served him well in the serious speeches. I mean, the speech that I watched that made me kind of fall in love with him as a candidate, he had this ability to know exactly what the audience was feeling and build on it. And that same ability works really well in comedy, where you hold a line for just long enough so that you're not letting all of the anticipation die down, but you're letting it build. And then right at the most important moment, right at the moment when the tension is highest, you break it with a punchline. Mm-hmm. And that's really hard to do. It's certainly not something most politicians can do, but he was able to do that.
Yeah, and I think that humor-wise, he kind of became known for something that the current president would never do, which is creating these sort of self-deprecating moments where he would say, you know, stuff like, oh, you know, I don't want to get in trouble with Michelle, or, you know, Michelle, she's the smart one. I remember it was like a sitcom dad or something. Oh, shucks, Vladimir, you know, I'll have to check with Michelle first.
Well, there is, I guess, a little sitcom dad to that. Although one of the things I always enjoyed was watching the First Lady's reactions during some of these jokes, because sometimes you just see her kind of shaking her head, like, in a way, I think many of us with a significant other know where that person's like, man, I love this person, but boy, they're an idiot. And there was something very nice and human about the fact that the president and his wife had that dynamic, just like so many people. But one of the pieces with thinking about some of the self-deprecating side of it too, some of it's about kind of acknowledging that human element, but some of it is also about recognizing that this is not just about kind of political stuff, right? We get sucked into everything a president says is political, and there's no way around that. Mm-hmm. But it's a chance to just let people laugh about something neutral. And to their credit, Ronald Reagan was very good at this. George W. Bush was a very funny guy in person. And this is not a partisan, or, you know, it's not Democratic presidents are good at joke telling, and in my opinion, Republican presidents aren't. I think for the most part, we've had presidents who get that being charming is a useful tool to deploy in the job.
Yeah, I think that you said in the book that he wasn't necessarily a fan of self-deprecating humor, but he saw the political necessity of it, and how if he could make fun of himself, he kind of had a license then to go after his political enemies a little bit.
Well,
poke them some.
Exactly. I don't think when I said that in the book, what I mean is that I don't think that those were his favorite jokes he got to tell. I think that if I had to guess, certainly our favorite jokes to write were the ones that tell a little truth about Washington in a way you can't normally in politics. That's kind of fun. It's a way to let out some of that frustration that, you know, we were feeling, and also a way to get around the political back and forth. But President Obama was, first of all, had a real sense of gallows humor. So one instance, it was not in a correspondence dinner, but one story I tell in the book, a friend of mine came into the White House in late 2013 to do technology policy. And this was right when healthcare.gov had just not gone very well.
Yeah.
And his boss introduced my friend to the president and said, you know, Mr. President, this is our new person on the Economic Council doing technology policy. And without missing a beat, President Obama says, you're not the guy who did my website, are you? And the ability to laugh at a moment when, I mean, that was a serious crisis for the administration. Yeah. It was putting Obamacare and the insurance of millions of people were at risk. Mm-hmm. The fact that he could laugh a little bit too, I think, speaks well of his ability to just manage to stay sane in such a high-pressure job.
Mm-hmm. And one aspect of being a speechwriter in the White House that you talk about that almost seems quaint now is you discuss the process of then having to run the speech by the fact checkers.
Yes.
Now, if there was anything in here that I think would come close to being your nemesis in the administration, it was probably the research department. Talk a little bit about that dynamic.
It's true. This is one of the many things in the book that was not supposed to seem old-fashioned, but now, only a few months after into the Trump presidency, it does. So the research department, and I say this in the book, you know, their job was to make sure that everything the president said was accurate. And we're seeing this now. That's an important position, and it's not just important for a president, because we didn't want to have the controversy where he said something untrue, but also it's important for America. The American people need to be able to believe whatever the White House is saying, regardless of the party of the person who holds the office. We need to be able to trust the White House. Also, at the same time, the research department and the speechwriters, I mean, we each bothered the heck out of each other because the researchers, and I think pretty fairly, recognize that most speechwriters have a little bit of novelist in them. The moment you let them loose, they're going to try for something, you know, they're going to try for something really soaring. And who knows where that's going to end up. And then the research department, they wanted to make sure there were no mistakes at all. So
that
anything—
things were accurately represented, right?
Exactly. Yeah. But that also meant that anything that could be fact-checked was fact-checked. So we would sometimes say things like, our economic policies are working. And they would say, not everyone would agree with that. And that is – it's true. Not everyone did agree with that. But we would say, well, we're trying to argue our case here.
Yeah.
You know, we, that's not really a fact. That's just – someone's got to say that our stuff is working, and we think it does, and we have evidence to prove it. But, you know, there would be moments like that. I remember one time the president all he had to do was repeat the Gettysburg Address. It was for some commemoration of the 150th anniversary. And as a joke, I sent around a fact-checked Gettysburg Address to everybody in the research and the speechwriting departments, which I'm sure made me a lot of friends. It had something to do with, you know, like 47 years ago. And I was like, well, really, it should be 47 years and 6 months ago. You know, that kind of edit we would get. And to be fair, the research department took it in stride. They didn't get too annoyed at me. But then they actually did fact check the Gettysburg Address for real. I forget what their fact checks were, but there were some legitimate points. And actually, to the research department's credit, I think what they found was that there's multiple versions that have been sort of written down, and they were making sure that the president was using the right version. So as with many things here, it was one of those examples where research was kind of, you know, I guess as you put it, they were we were kind of constantly having this back and forth. But now especially I look back and I say, man, it was nice to have the biggest thing I worried about be like, are these speeches going to be too accurate?
Yeah, I wonder where they are now. I have to think they must have gotten shipped off to Guam or like Nome, Alaska or something.
That's right. I think it's sort of like what the DiGiorno delivery guy, right? Is the Trump fact checker. That's it's just somebody with their feet kicked back and a drink with an umbrella in it saying like, oh, this is a great job.
What were some of the other no-nos when you're writing a speech for the president?
So there were all sorts of things that a president really can't say or shouldn't say. Mm-hmm. When it came to jokes, we would draw some pretty bright lines, for example, at national security. So the president would never make a joke that even in hindsight, you know, let's say next week there's, you know, God forbid, a terrorist attack or a natural disaster. You never want that joke to look like it was in poor taste.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing President Obama was pretty clear about, it's not like we had a list of rules, but you could intuit just by knowing who he was that we tried to, when we were making fun of someone, make fun of someone for the reason they deserved it. So, for example, you know, comedy writers, their job is to pitch everything, just think about what they think is funny. So every year we would see a couple of pitches where the idea of the joke was making fun of Chris Christie because of his size. Maybe he said something ridiculous, but the joke was Chris Christie's
personal.
A big guy.
Yeah.
And those never made it into the speech because we thought, you know, if we're going to make fun of Chris Christie, maybe it's because we think he deserves it, but it's not because he's a big guy. It's because of something else.
Mm-hmm.
And even now, I mean, I'm sure that I don't always adhere to it, but when I'm just in my personal life where the stakes are much, much lower, trying to make fun of Trump, I try not, you know, the sort of like making fun of him because he's orange, right? It is true. That's a characteristic of his, but that to me is not, I try to not do that.
You began writing more speeches directly for the president. And as your star was on the rise at the White House, it seemed that the universe was sort of falling apart. There was the rise of ISIS. There was racial strife. Obamacare was under assault. Did you feel a little bit like you were back at your old job in constant crisis mode?
I think the White House is always in constant crisis mode. Mm-hmm. When things were going well, there was always a reason that things were about to start going poorly. When there were crises happening around the world, it was our job to think about how to deal with them. So one of the things that I got used to in the White House was these sort of cycles. I mean, the press would call them Obama's Katrina moments, right, where they would basically declare the Obama presidency over and then we would do a bunch of work and no one would really give us a lot of credit. The number of stories after the crisis had passed was usually several orders of magnitude smaller than the stories in the midst of the crisis. But you gradually learn that skill of perseverance and resilience to say, you know, we don't know how things are going to turn out, but we'll keep our eye on the ball. The the other thing I will say, too, is that when I worked at the crisis communications firm, I felt like most of those firms deserved to be in crisis. Yeah. And for us, I mean, these were legitimately important things happening around the world. We weren't necessarily perfect in dealing with any of them, but it was a far cry from the coal company that doesn't follow worker safety laws.
Yeah, and during that second term, President Obama tried to, of course, pass bipartisan immigration reform. You were involved in that process. You wrote his signature immigration speech, I believe. And you were writing something that offered, I guess, more of an olive branch to Republicans and those who wanted maybe more of a mix of enforcement and opportunity in the immigration package. The president was on an entirely different page, tone-wise. What was he going for?
Well, I sat down and I wrote the speech, I wouldn't say just to offer an olive branch to Republicans, but what we called UFGs, which are up for grabs Americans, in a campaign that's basically undecided voters. But in a policy standpoint, right, in a policy standpoint, it's people who don't know exactly how they feel about this issue. And more importantly, how they feel about the issue is often informed by how the issue is presented.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I had kind of framed the speech, was how do we get as many up for grabs Americans as possible on our side? And that's the way I think we had thought about things through the 2014 midterms. And what I wrote about was this shift in tone in the last few years where – from the moment we started the meeting and the president hadn't read the draft, it was clear he wanted to talk about all those things. I mean, the final speech included a lot about border security. It included that we were going to require undocumented immigrants to pay back taxes, pay a fine, learn English. So it was all in there, but it was the way it was organized. It started with this moral case to say, we're a nation of immigrants. Is it really right that we allow people who make our beds and pick our fruit, we let them work here, but then they have to live in constant fear that we're going to send them to another country? And that was a shift that I saw in the serious speeches and then also in some of the jokes. And it was a moment in the final 2 years of the administration where it did feel in some ways more like the 2008 campaign, because we were leading with the values and leading with the moral case. And there was something really gratifying about that. And I'm glad that I was there for that part of the Obama presidency, as well as some of the more as you pointed out, you know, some of the more administration struggling with healthcare.gov, or, you know, the moment ISIS came about. I was there for those moments, but I also got to be there during this time when I think we did recapture something essential about the 2008 campaign and bring it into government.
Yeah, and love him or hate him, I think that's something that did come across to the American people that I have to give him credit for, is in that final year or two, he didn't act like much of a lame duck. I mean, you say that his attitude was, let's not just run out the clock here. Let's go for it and see how much we can actually get done before I'm out of office.
That's exactly right. And I write about being in a meeting, a senior staff meeting in the Roosevelt Room. And not, to be fair, the really senior staff meeting at 7:30 a.m. I got to go to the 9 a.m. senior staff meeting, which was for the slightly less senior staff. And it was right, it was the day after the midterm elections, the morning, you know, we had just lost more seats than we thought possible. And President Obama walked in and said, I want to get every bit of juice out of the next 2 years that I can. And I will say, I sat in the, or stood in the corner thinking, there's no way that's going to happen. And it was one of many times where President Obama, he kept his eye on the ball, and he was absolutely right. And the sort of the doubts that I had in that moment, they were wrong. And it was inspiring and exciting to see him say, you know what, I understand that the political back and forth is supposed to mean that we lost big, so I'm going to scale back my ambition. But I believe in what I'm doing, and my staff believes in what we're doing, and we're going to do whatever we can.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things, in the same way that I was totally wrong when I thought that the final 2 years were going to be more of a lame duck situation than they turned out, I did want to write a White House book about all the times I got it wrong, because I did feel like that was a entry into the genre that's a little different than most of the White House books. Peggy Noonan, who wrote a terrific White House memoir, said once that most White House books could be subtitled, "They should have listened to me." And I will say they should not have listened to me. I mean, there were a few times where maybe I made a good choice, but for the most part, and I write about all these in the book, there were plenty of times where I was in my 20s, I didn't know what I was doing. And so I'm very glad that no one said, oh, what does David think about this?
Well, it does sound like toward the end, the president was a little more comfortable in his own skin, humor-wise. I guess that sense of let's just go for it even permeated his sense of humor. Give us an example of a joke that maybe wouldn't have made the cut during the first term, but was fair game toward the end there.
Well, the joke that to me perfectly captured the last 2 years of the Obama presidency was one that a friend of mine named Andrew Law, he's a comedy writer in Los Angeles, he sent it in. And the joke was, after the midterm elections, my advisors asked me, "Do you have, Mr. President, do you have a bucket list?" And I told them, "Well, I have something that rhymes with bucket list." And then the president said, "You know, take action on immigration? Bucket. New climate change regulations? Bucket." And I remember thinking, first of all, the odds of him using this joke are pretty small, because he wasn't swearing, but it was pretty clear what he was saying.
Yeah.
And then second of all, there's no way that if he uses it, if he does one bucket, that's, we're going to, you know, we're going to have like the radio rule, right? There is, you get one.
Yeah, you got to have.
And that's it.
Yeah.
And that was not at all. I mean, he saw it, was like, this is funny.
Yeah,
we're going to do it.
Down.
Yeah. And the only change he made, and I think it was one of those moments when the joke writing process reflected something more important. He made one change, which was to add after bucket about the climate change regulations. He said, "Bucket. It's the right thing to do." And that was his addition. Hmm. It's the right thing to do. And I think it was reflective of not just how he was telling a joke, but also of his own thinking about it and of the sort of broader collective attitude we had in the White House in that moment.
What was the most emotional experience for you during your time there? Something that maybe did feel like the West Wing, where you really felt the weight of the moment in history.
Yeah. There were two. The night of the bin Laden raid. Which I was at a music festival that day and came back, and we were in the car on the way back, and I saw a final draft of the speech saying on the death of Osama bin Laden. And that was a remarkable moment for me because I grew up in New York City. I was in 10th grade when 9/11 happened. And a few days after 9/11, I could smell smoke in my bedroom as it kind of drifted over. And that moment when the person who was responsible for this, it wasn't so much that he was dead, but just that we had brought justice to this person. It was a more moving, more cathartic moment than I expected. Another moment that I felt would have been perfectly suited to the West Wing theme song was in 2015. It was one of those days where you just can't believe this much history happens at the same time. So the day before, the Affordable Care Act had been upheld by the Supreme Court for the second time. And we had been worried that after all of this fighting, the law was going to be overturned. And not, by the way, by Congress or by the American people, but just by a sort of what we considered a flimsy constitutional argument. It wasn't. It was upheld. And then the next day, the marriage equality decision came down and gay marriage was now legal in all 50 states. And then that day, President Obama went to Charleston and delivered that speech where he sang Amazing Grace at that service.
Yeah,
and I watched that.
That was after the Charleston shooting?
After the Charleston shooting.
Yeah.
And I watched that speech from the live stream on my computer. I mean, I wasn't on the trip or anything like that, but like Americans everywhere, I watched him say those words and have that moment where he led this congregation in song. And that night, my fiance and I, at the time she was my girlfriend, we went down to the White House, and the whole place was lit up in the colors of the rainbow because of the marriage equality decision. And there were couples, straight couples, gay couples. Everybody was there. It was just one of those moments where everyone in Washington feels like they need to be at the White House.
Mm-hmm.
And you're looking up at this place where the president lives, and you're thinking about how different the country is because of the person who lives there and because of everybody who worked for him and worked so hard to put him there. And that was not most of my time at the White House. Most of it was much more Veep than West Wing. But those moments like that are the things that happen when you put in all the work during the frustrating times and you do all the little things right.
Yeah, and you talk about how you felt lucky because you were able to leave the White House when you could still leave feeling that the country was going to be all right. You'd set it off on the right course, as opposed to those who had left after the election. Do you feel any disillusionment that you spent 7 or 8 years having to check your comedic instincts sometimes and often having to not go for the punchline in order to preserve the dignity of the office of the president? But now suddenly it turns out that none of that matters because the president can act like a schmuck and say whatever pops into his mind and he still gets elected.
Well, I would say, obviously, I would have very much like to write the epilogue of my book where Hillary Clinton beat Donald Trump in the election and Republicans were coming to terms with what had happened and trying to figure out how to be a more responsible political party going forward. That epilogue did not happen. I had to rewrite a bunch. I don't think that we're living in an era where nothing matters. It gives me hope that the American people are not excited about this. I mean, when we were at 40% approval, that's the kind of existential crisis that we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. When you say, did you feel like you were at a crisis communications firm because President Obama was at 40% approval? George W. Bush, 3 months after Katrina, was at 40% approval. I believe this morning, Trump, who's been on a little bit of a rebound as we record this, is at like 39.5% or 38%. So, and the economy is doing pretty well, which is normally the main driver of approval one way or the other. So the American people, I think, recognize that this is not what we want out of our president. And I hope that we can get through this period and find a way to reestablish the dignity of the office.
And I should point out before we go that you haven't left D.C. since leaving the White House. You're actually head writer and producer for the D.C. arm of Funny or Die. What kind of stuff are you working on there?
Well, as a representative of a comedy company in Washington, I kind of get to be in it but not of it, yeah. Which is a nice change of pace. And what we do, so Funny or Die,
Will Ferrell's
yeah, company.
Website.
They also produce Between Two Ferns with Zach Galifianakis. Mm-hmm. And when I was at the White House, they were the ones who brought Zach and the crew in to film with President Obama.
Right.
One of those moments where I thought this was going to be a terrible idea. Glad no one asked me for my opinion because it turned out to help save the Affordable Care Act. And after that happened, the Funny or Die team in Los Angeles said, wait a second, we could do this for other organizations. So we work with, let's say, we've worked with the League of Conservation Voters or the American Heart Association. Sometimes we've worked with more direct advocacy groups or helped people raise money like the ACLU.
Okay.
And we are using comedy to try to both influence the political debate in small ways, but also just to bring attention to causes that deserve it. Mm-hmm. And so many things, especially now when we're all focused on what did Donald Trump tweet today or what are the six things he tweeted today and there's no room for anything else, sometimes comedy is the way to break through with a cause that might not otherwise get the attention it needs.
Yeah, definitely. You're having more fun?
It's definitely more fun. It's nice to know also that if I don't do a good job, I am not letting down either my country or my president in even the smallest way. So there's that pressure that you just live with at the White House and it internalizes itself. And I will say there's things I miss about the White House, but that constant feeling of responsibility like it's nice to have taken a little break from that.
Well, it was a very fun read. Again, David Litt's book is called Thanks, Obama, My Hopey Changey White House Years. David, thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much.
Today's episode was sponsored by Nadex. Want to try day trading markets but worried about the risk? What if you could choose your maximum risk and reward up front? Well, you can with binary options on Nadex. Trade global stock indexes, commodities, Forex, even economic numbers, all from one account and always with limited risk. See why over 100,000 members choose Nadex. Find out more at Nadex.com. Trading on Nadex involves risk and may not be appropriate for all investors. Thanks again to David Litt for joining me on the podcast. Order his new book, Thanks, Obama, My Hopey Changey White House Years on Amazon, or download the audio version at audible.com. Follow David on Twitter at @DavidLitt and check out some of his latest shenanigans at funnyordie.com. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review while you're there. Don't forget to take our listener survey. It only takes 5 minutes at podsurvey.com/kick. You can visit Kick-Ass News on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And be sure to recommend Kick-Ass News to your friends on your social media. And if you really want to help out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at gofundme.com/kickassnews or click on the donate button at kickassnews.com. As always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, though, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.